Okay, my name is Rochelle Bolton. I work at the Utah Department of Health in the informatics program. And one of the things that we've started in the past year is to really try and assess data quality globally throughout our entire communicable disease surveillance system. And so that's been one of the projects that I've been working on. And so I'm just going to present kind of one of our first steps that we took. So CDC's guidelines for evaluating public health surveillance systems lists 9 system attributes that should be assessed. Data quality is one of those. Data quality is a bit of a nebulous term, but it essentially means that the data that you've collected is good enough for whatever purpose you collected it for. Specifically related to public health, this means that the data accurately reflects the trends in the diseases or conditions under surveillance. The CDC guidelines state that examining the percentage of unknown or blank responses to items on surveillance forms is a straightforward and easy measure of data quality. Data of high quality will have low percentages of such responses. And so as I've talked with my colleagues, this is typically what they cite as evidence that their data is of good quality, that they deem that it's complete. However, from the many projects over the past 8 or so years that I've worked on to improve data quality, the completeness of the data was often not the initial trigger that there was a data quality issue. And so we thought there's got to be some other things that we can look at to provide a more comprehensive view of our data quality. So in the past year at the Utah Department of Health, we've piloted a project to assess data quality using 6 different metrics. I'd like to present these metrics to you and advocate for more comprehensive data quality assessments. So I just spent the past couple of minutes trying to convince you that completeness is not a fantastic indicator of quality, and now I'm going to convince you not to give up on it entirely. So as I mentioned before, complete data has a small percentage of blank or unknown responses. Essentially, it's just an indicator of the availability of your data. If data is easily available, it's going to be pretty complete. But data doesn't need to be 100% complete to still have high quality. The problem comes when your unknowns are not randomly distributed. So in Utah, approximately 30% of our enteric cases are lost to follow-up, meaning we just never were able to get a hold of them. So we were never able to collect exposure history. 70% completeness isn't necessarily poor, but most of our lost to follow-up cases are from rural jurisdictions or they're Hispanic, so it's not randomly distributed. Our rural jurisdictions revolve highly around agriculture, and so we're probably underestimating the amount of animal or secondary water exposures that are resulting in disease. So our enteric team puts a really good amount of effort into multiple contact attempts at various times of the day. So in reality, there probably really isn't much that they can do to boost that completeness percentage. But simply just understanding the limitations of their data and how their unknowns can skew their interpretations and their analyses can really help. So the second factor that we look at is timeliness. And data is timely when it's available when you need it. Data that isn't timely can actually affect your completeness. I'm going to take you back in time to 2006 when I started working at the Utah Department of Health as a vaccine preventable disease epidemiologist. Pertussis was at the time, and actually still is, a high volume disease. As I became familiar with the investigations and the analyses that had been done prior to my arrival, I became actually concerned with one question, and it was this question: how long did the patient's cough last? So pertussis is colloquially known as the 100-day cough for a reason. It lasts forever. Were investigators actually following somebody that long to determine how long they had coughed for? That seemed like an enormous task and probably a little bit of a waste of time. They weren't. So they were collecting how long the patient had been coughing at the time of the interview. But they weren't actually collecting what we were asking for. So this was a problem because we had done analyses to look at the average amount of time that a patient was coughing for, and people were distributing that information, and it wasn't the information that we were collecting. So ultimately, the data that we wanted to collect, the total time that a pertussis patient coughed for, was not timely in relation to investigation timeframes and the quality suffered. Oftentimes, there are different sources whereby you can collect the same information, but the quality of the data can vary by those sources. One source might be easily accessible and timely, but have lower quality. And making the decisions on where to get that data, weighing the accessibility versus the quality, can often be pretty challenging. So when we investigate a case, we collect a lot of different types of information, some of which I've listed on the screen. We also have a number of different data sources where we can get that data from. Just like you wouldn't call up a laboratory expecting to get an exposure history on the patient, you wouldn't use the patient interview to ask for additional laboratory testing information or medical diagnoses made during a hospitalization. This sounds pretty obvious, but there can be situations where accessing the best data for a particular question can be difficult or even near impossible. So influenza hospitalizations in Utah are a reportable condition, and we collect some basic information on those cases, like chronic medical conditions, illness-associated complications, like encephalitis, and medical interventions like ventilation. We had one local health department that had a really difficult time getting medical records from one of their hospitals. So they would substitute the patient interview as that source of information. And so you can guess that, you know, whether the patient received antivirals or was diagnosed with encephalitis probably wasn't really great coming from a patient interview, particularly, you know, an 80-year-old gentleman who was transferred from the long-term care facility. So most of their data was incomplete or unreliable. We needed to work with the local health department and their hospital to make accessing those records easier so that we can improve that quality data. So an accurate surveillance system has data that exactly measures or represents the true value. And a primary way to measure accuracy is by determining how well the data in the surveillance system was transcribed from the original sources. So assessing accuracy requires external validation of the data and is actually an incredibly time-consuming process. However, from my experience, accuracy errors have profound implications on quality data. And so one of the things that we did this past year hepatitis C laboratory data entry assessment. So laboratory data can be incredibly complex, and hepatitis C is pretty complex. When you have a surveillance system that collects data on more than 70 reportable diseases, the data entry staff has to be really well trained in order to interpret those laboratory results and enter those appropriately. So what we did for hepatitis C was we compared what the data entry staff had entered into our surveillance system, which is what our investigators at the local and state level use to determine whether it's an acute case, to set a case status. It's really important data. We compared that to what they had actually received on the fax sheets. We found that only 66% of the labs had been entered entirely correctly. So problems identified included entering the wrong test type, which can be problematic when a screening test is interpreted as a confirmatory test. Just a misinterpretation of a result, which can be troublesome if someone with active infection is classified as being resolved. And just incomplete data entry, so vital pieces of information were just missing. Of the 34% of laboratory reports that had been incorrectly entered, so this 66%, 34% of those had an incorrect case status based off of that that wrong data. So you could see what the impact that had on our data. So the inaccuracy in these fields had a substantial effect on the conclusions that we were drawing about our population. So through a careful assessment, going back and looking through what our problems were, we were able to identify the specific test types that our data entry staff was having some trouble with, as well as the specific laboratories that were actually sending us subpar information. We were able to make some improvements there, which drastically changed how the accuracy of how well our data entry staff was putting that into our system. So for certain types of data, you expect the values to fall within a certain range. Examples can be height, age, body temperature, and data is valid when it just conforms to these requirements. So the best method for ensuring valid data, which has actually been presented to us already, is is preventing it from entering your database in the first place. That's done through program validity checks. I think you call them concerns and stoppers. Examples of validity checks could be deactivating the pregnancy field if male is selected, or if a female is perhaps outside of an accepted age range. You may want to put in an upper and a lower limit for temperature if you're collecting fever-related data. For us, during the 2009 influenza pandemic, we collected height and weight information to look at how obesity was related to the severity of our cases. We ended up calculating some pretty unbelievable body mass indexes because we had a lot of transcription errors in the height and weight information. If we had put some validity checks on those fields, we wouldn't have had to spend as much time following up on those cases to correct that for our analyses. So precision is actually has less to do with the actual data values and more to do with questions and value sets in the database. So the quality of data can be significantly affected by questions that are ambiguous or involve some sort of interpretation on the part of the individual collecting or entering the data. I think of precision as forcing a square peg of data into a round hole in the database. From my experience, precision is one of the primary metrics that affects data quality. And so I'm going to take you back to our pertussis question. How long did the patient's cough last? So cough duration is really crucial to establishing a case definition, as we need to know if the patient coughed for at least 2 weeks to be considered clinically compatible. While technically this question has had a high percentage of completeness at our health department, it was provided us with usable information for establishing a case definition only 60% of the time. And that was because our investigators would often write, still coughing. So we knew where they were coughing, but we still didn't know how long they'd been coughing for. So it occurred to me that what we actually wanted to know wasn't what we were asking. What we really wanted to know was, did the patient's cough last at least 2 weeks? Once we made that change in our forms and our database, we got usable information 92% of the time. And so that meant that our investigators at the state had to do a lot less follow-up. And we were able to precisely collect exactly what we needed. And so just a slight change in the way that we worded that question to actually more accurately reflect exactly what we wanted to know had a pretty substantial change in the quality of the data that we were collecting. And so, as I mentioned at the beginning, this past year we piloted a comprehensive, structured project with two diseases in an attempt to improve data quality. We used hepatitis C, past or present, and Campylobacter. We started with a formal assessment of the data collected during the surveillance process using these six data quality metrics I presented, and were able to identify a number of weaknesses in the system. We asked our epidemiologists to work through a few other exercises to identify additional problems with their current surveillance process, which has led to changes in the forms, the data collection process, the database, and the way that they analyze the data. Right now, the epidemiologists are finalizing these changes and working with the local health departments to implement them. After the new processes have been up and running for a few months, we're actually going to reassess the data that's been collected at that point against these six metrics to try and quantify the improvements that that occurred in that system. So I'm hoping that we can bring those results to you next year. But in conclusion, comprehensive data quality assessments are necessary to ensure that data being used for public health surveillance purposes are collected, entered, stored, and analyzed appropriately. Exhaustive data quality assessments are particularly useful for public health systems that are already stressed for resources because they really allow for a refinement of the surveillance process and assist in program evaluation efforts by identifying gaps in data collection, data entry, and database structure. With this pilot project, you know, all of our EPIs, most of them were like, I don't have time to do that. That's just another thing on top of all of the other things that I have to do. But with our two pilot diseases, what they really said was, they said, we put in a substantial amount of effort up front, but the time that we're saving and the data that we're collecting now makes up for it. And so it was a hard sell, but they've bought into it. So that was good. So the six metrics that I've proposed will assist public health departments in maintaining high quality data across the broad spectrum of the surveillance process. So, are there any questions?